Hi, my name's Bruce Peterson and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com.
All right, my guest this week is Bruce Peterson, founder and executive chairman of Grande Experiences. Thanks for coming in. I'm going to ask you first, seeing as I'm heading to Europe in about 12 days, when was the last time you were back in Rome?
About 11 days ago.
Really? You're kidding? Yeah.
No, I was back over in Europe for about 5 weeks okay. And just got back 10, 11 days ago.
So did you do the classic Italian holiday? Perfect time of year to be going as well.
Yeah, look, we probably tend to do the less classical these days. Having a business over there and having lived there for a year, we love to visit, but we love to go somewhere different and new. So this year I spent quite a bit of time in the very, very south of Puglia.
All right.
Yeah, about as far south as you could go.
Okay, very nice. And when you stay in Rome normally, because I know, pretty sure you guys own that museum now, the private museum, which we'll get onto later, because I love Rome, always stay around Villa Borghese.
Yep.
What's sort of like your go-to area to stay?
Yeah, well, our museum's in Piazza del Popolo, and that's arguably my favourite place of Rome as well. It's a beautiful people's square, and it's at the foot of Borghese, as you know, and it's part of a walk that I like to do at early hours before Rome wakes up. But we tend to stay around Via Babuino or the top of the Corso there, and I've got a couple of choice apartments that I like to stay in that area.
Yeah. I love Rome. It's always, it's always funny how people, because Rome is such, it's like a megapolis for tourists, how much you get pulled into the very, very center of Rome, for most people at least, and you miss things like so many people I know who've been to Rome twice don't know what Villa Borghese is. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I think when I first went to Rome as a backpacker, and you had those old McDonald's maps out that showed the toilets on there and things like that. But I remember navigating myself around Rome, and it took all day and you were dead tired on your feet. Whereas now I can go out to dinner, and if I've got my wife with me or daughter, at the end of dinner we can just say, right, let's just walk dinner off and we'll do a tour of all the main sites so we can hit Spanish Steps, Trevi Fountain, Pantheon, Piazza Navona, and then back to Piazza del Popolo in like an hour.
Yeah, that's the way to do Rome. I reckon there's less of the touristy going to, like, you have to go to this museum, have to go inside the Colosseum and all that. I think just, letting yourself absorb it, thinking about what life would have been like 1,000 years ago, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm reading at the moment about the history of Rome, but the buildings there, because they've got so much history within the buildings, and, you just don't know what's behind the closed doors all the time in Rome. You're walking past something that just has a facade, but everything happens behind or it happens under, and it has so many secrets that we'll never know about, and I'm just fascinated to try and unlock a few of them.
Yeah. Tell me, what do you reckon is your earliest memory?
Wow. Earliest memory was being picked up by a truck driver on Madura Avenue in Canberra, where I was born as about a two and a half year old, as I was scooting up the main road on my little tricycle tractor thing. I'd escaped out, and I was joining the big boys on the main road.
Right. So when you say he picked you up, like he literally grabbed you and said, "You're going back home."
He pulled over, and I just have memories of being sort of knocked on the door and walked in and, "Is this your son?" My mum was horrified.
Yeah, right. What did your parents do for work growing up?
Yeah, look, my father, he was a Commonwealth driver, so he was the driver of Gough Whitlam when Gough Whitlam was Prime Minister.
Wow.
He drove Princess Di and Prince Charles and Joe Bjorklie Peterson. There's a blast from the past and lots of stories there. And my mother, she had a varied career of nursing through to medical reception, But in the earlier days, you know, she was in the Air Force, you know, post-war.
Yeah, Commonwealth drivers, but the stories and things that they would hear. That'd be a brilliant podcast.
If you could get the old guys, because they all used to sit around the Rex Hotel and drink all day whilst Parliament was sitting, really? And then they'd disperse and go and pick up all the ministers, and I'm sure most of them were half cut by the time they picked up the.
That's amazing. Oh my god, yeah. It just reminds me of there was one of my favorite TV shows in a while on the ABC was called. Rake or the Rake, and it's about like a guy who's a lawyer and he builds himself up all the way into Parliament and then somehow becomes a Chief Justice, and it's just like he's an absolute, like he's, you know, he's doing heroin or crack cocaine and so he's just a mess.
Yeah.
And his Commonwealth driver is hilarious, like just the things that he does. Yeah. It's brilliant. What's the most memorable thing or lesson do you reckon that your parents have told you?
I think from my mum, the big one that sits is, you know, being responsible for your own actions.
Okay.
You know, that's a big one. I think in particular I've got, you know, kids now, but I'm also looking at a generation that I think wants to absolve themselves of responsibility quite a bit and push it onto somewhere else. Having said that, on the flip side of that, I think they're taking on far more responsibility on bigger and broader issues, around the climate change and, you know, around topics that are really, really important to them at the moment of diversity and alike. How they go about it might be, you know, strange for us of a different generation or alike. But responsibility, and I think we saw it through COVID, how a government dictated what we did and how we should do it, yet really you want people to take responsibility for themselves. And so taking responsibility for their own health, for example, as a business owner or a company owner, do I need to mandate that you wear a mask in the office to protect other people and yourselves, or should you have that personal responsibility to say, hey, I'm vulnerable, I should take that responsibility on myself to protect myself.
Mm. And how did your mum sort of impart that on you? Like, what was the way that she said it or tried to emphasize it, do you think?
Yeah, I think we were allowed to make mistakes.
Right.
Okay. I'm not sure we allow our kids to make anywhere near the same mistakes as we made.
Yeah.
We don't allow them to take the risks like we used to take, but then it was always, well, that's the consequence of your actions.
Right.
So you own it. So if you want to go out and do something dangerous and fall out of the tree and break your arm, well, you know, that's part of the responsibility of doing something that's a little risky.
Mm.
But we were allowed to do all that. We were allowed to explore. You know, people of my age and generation were out on the streets because we didn't have anything else to occupy ourselves. So we were out playing the whole time. And with that, you get into a bit of trouble and you do things and you push the boundaries and you work out where things are, but it always comes back to it's not someone else's fault. I'm not blaming my mother for allowing me to go out and play on the streets, right? The responsibility comes back to me of what I'm doing when I'm out on the streets.
So over time, as a generation, it sort of sounds like baby boomers would take a risk on things and it could be any topic, and over time, as a group, you guys, whether socially or maybe legislatively even, let's say, taking the example of COVID, have made it so that this next, let's say, would you say the next generation is Gen Z or millennials?
Oh, look, I'll probably not.
Because your daughter's sort of, she'd be that age.
They're more millennial, yeah. Yeah, my kids. But there are huge differences, but that's normal and natural. I think the one thing that I keep trying to say to my kids is don't try and impose your values of today on the values of yesterday. They're different eras and you shouldn't try and compare, nor should you go back in retrospect. You know, deal with what's today. And it's an age-old argument even in sport. You know, who's the better player? Someone that played, you know, Lee Matthews in the 70s, you know, early 80s, or, you know, Gary Ablett playing in the 2020s. You can't compare across eras because they're playing different games, even though it's the same, but through different things. And I think it's the same with where we're at in society is, we've got disparity and there's always been disparity, but it's quite a big gap now between the young ones and the older ones in their thinking. And the younger ones are trying to shut down the older ones because they don't appreciate the values that a lot of the older generation carry.
The interesting thing about that will be in the next few years, I just listened to a podcast this morning. I think the baby boomer generation is sort of, what do they call it? Like the wealthiest generation ever. It's going to be fascinating to see what the impact of, they're saying it's going to be the biggest wealth transfer ever in history. And what will that do? You know, of the percentage of that wealth, what portion gets given away because that becomes a bigger trend? And then what portion is handed down to a generation that the difference between the haves and the have-nots are bigger, but then all of a sudden they're lumped with a bunch of money because their parents were asset rich but maybe income poor. So it's going to be very interesting. It's a fascinating time right now. I mean, we're speaking now in August. Nancy Pelosi's just visited Taiwan. Ukraine's going on. For me, it's big because the podcast I was listening to this morning was about that, about how one of the people in particular believes that we're going through a decoupling with places like China and Russia, and the other believes that we're going to a system that is less global in terms of trade, which I found really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll find out in the next 3 years.
Well, look, my business is a global business. Until we opened the Loom here in Melbourne, we were pretty much 99% of our income overseas. And so I've lived it for the last 15 years and have seen this trend and almost been arguing for it, five, six, 7 years ago, because we were getting way too close and dependent on others and not enough independence ourselves on some key essential things. So like anything, if you put all your eggs in one basket and then that basket, gets taken away or gets a hole in it or crumbles, well, you're in a risk position. And I think Australia had worked itself into a bit of a risk position with its reliance in particular on China, essentially the main exports that we have, what's in our ground, education and tourism. And all of those sort of dried up pretty quickly.
Yeah. And dirt, essentially, mining.
Yeah.
Relying on those, it's a problem. I wondered for a while based off this talk that I was listening to, like we're going to become less reliant on the US as well. That's going to be like a big trend as they become a little bit more insular. They're moving away from the idea of having to protect everyone. They're much more focused on their own internal policy, and you can see that in their politics. That being said, they're still obviously the global superpower, but does that mean that Australia – I feel like I've seen a mental shift in Australians due to COVID and like maybe since 2019 and this stuff with China, like our identity is changing. You see things like the Republican debate come up more. Like do we go for a big Australia? Does the population double in the next 20 years and does that change us? It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's another phenomena in there that perhaps hasn't been taken into account is this generation is and our next leaders by and large have much more of a moral compass, and they'd like to combine capitalism with that moral compass. But it's interesting because the US is on the nose as much as China's on the nose. There's a real struggle here with the safety in the US, the gun laws, the abortion laws, the damage Donald Trump's done to, the brand of the US. It's not that great appeal like it was perhaps to the generations before. So they're sort of saying, well, okay, if I'm not going to do business in or with the US, well, so be it, because I don't really resonate with them anyway. And of course China's been very much the same with human rights and some of the rhetoric that's been coming out there. So I think things like that will lead Australia a little bit more insular as well.
Yeah. Make us think about doing stuff more locally or expanding more locally. Because that, you're right, that's always been a thing. It's like you start a company, you get big, what do?
Yeah.
Go to the US or China. Yeah, it's a good point, actually. I've been saying this to our staff and a few other friends like the last year. Yeah, the US, I don't know. I think Australia is so good. This country is so bloody good. Like, you know, these issues they have with gun laws, we don't have it. People say, oh, well, you can't have healthcare and be a world superpower. But like, if you look at it, we spend the same percentage of GDP on defense. Doesn't make sense. They spend more on health and they got a worse system.
Yeah.
I wonder the next few decades, does this become like a real growth period for us? Do you get more Americans coming over? I've noticed there's a trend actually just being focused on that area of like TikTok and the Gen Z generation. I noticed that more and more of Americans coming over here as skilled labor and being like, this is great. This is amazing. Like, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because Australians are pretty well travelled by and large. We get to see what's happening around the world, which can reaffirm actually how good it is back in Australia.
Yeah.
But I think we need a little bit more reaffirmation amongst ourselves because Australians get down on Australia a bit too easily and a bit too through the media in particular. You know, we tend to be quite negative about many aspects of life in Australia, but it's incomparable. You know, having lived overseas, it's difficult to live in a lot of other countries around the world. Yeah. You know, it's easy in Australia when it comes to freedom, movement, education, healthcare, you know, all the essential things. Not for everybody, of course, but it's a broad generalization. For the majority, this is a pretty easy country to live in compared to others around the world.
Yeah, class movement in Australia is very easy in comparison to most Western countries.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I guess this is the interesting thing for you because you've lived it, you've lived overseas as you were initially launching the business. I mean, you said to me earlier, I'm not on social media, and you can tell when you go on LinkedIn because it's, you know, it's, you've got the board membership at Top Shelf International Holdings, you've got, Grande Experiences in the Loom. And there's obviously a gap there for the bloke who studied PE, geography and environmental science, but I can pick up from when you went to go do the Da Vinci exhibition. But tell me, before that, that 86 to sort of 05 period, what were you doing with yourself?
Being a chameleon, I think. Look, in many ways, trying my hand at many different things. I started out life as a teacher, and that was great for a period of time. You know, I was a phys ed teacher, but I quickly, I suppose, tired of that. I couldn't see really much of a future for myself in that. It's an honourable profession, and I've got mates who are still teaching, and you know, for those that are good at it and thrive in it and love it, great. But it wasn't for me. So I hopped out of there into the pharmaceutical industry. So I used my physiology background and I suppose communication background and moved in and worked for a company called Merck Sharp and Dohme.
Okay.
Or Merck is their US parent company. And look, the time I was there, nothing to do with me, of course. They were Fortune 500 number one company for 5 years in a row. So I was thrown this tremendous amount of personal development and training, and I learnt a huge amount. But I also was coming from this education bubble. I'd been a student, then I'd gone to university as a, you know, basically doing a teaching degree, and then went and taught. So you live in this artificial bubble a little bit as a teacher when it comes to the commercial world. So Merck provided a stepping stone, but I didn't resonate with working for a multinational. In fact, I hated it. And so I took time out for a year and I travelled as a person of 25. So I finished a long-term relationship, sold a house and threw the job in and took off overseas for 12 months to go and find myself. And I hit about 36 countries, I think, in that 12 months, and everywhere from South America, you know, through to Europe, into Asia and back home. And Well, I won't say I went and found myself. I certainly realised that I wanted to do something a little bit extraordinary with my life, and not just float along and be comfortable with what life threw at me. I wanted to actually try and dictate my life a little bit more. Mm. And so I worked out a couple of the blocks and barriers whilst I was away, and I decided I would start my own business. I didn't know what it was in when I got back, and and then I moved in and started a sales and marketing company, and introduced large format digital printing into Australia. I was right at the forefront of that. So
interesting.
Did the big switcheroo for most corporate companies from photographic process to digital process in a printing.
So were you selling machines to like corporates, or were you
hooked up with a couple of guys who had the technology, and they were, if you like, selling back into the trade and to the agencies.
Okay.
And I just took the approach, why go through the middleman, just go direct to the end client. So I was bypassing the ad agencies and the other print companies and those that thought they had a mortgage on the end client. And within 12 months, I think I'd build up about 280 corporate clients.
Wow.
Direct, you know, into just supplying them direct with print. Everyone from L'Oreal to Mercedes to the new Westfield centres to, agricultural companies, with
display units. You probably know my dad. So he's a printer, Complete Colour Printing, based in Melbourne. He would have done some sort of work for all that, all those sort of companies back in the day.
Yeah.
But he's one of the few independents that are left.
Yeah.
It's amazing what has happened to that industry.
Yeah.
Like printing in general.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I was only in it for a 3 years. It wasn't for me long term, but it was a great stepping stone, and I earned quite well out of it to then enable me to, to keep moving. So,
and did you do anything before this trip? Before that trip to Rome? You know,
just recently.
With the printing.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I started up a couple of other businesses. I had a high end travel business, which sort of internal motto was, if you could find it in a brochure, we didn't offer it. So I was setting up these, experiences for very high wealth. Net worth individuals overseas, Russians and Americans and alike on very bespoke trips and tours. The problem for that I wasn't suited to dealing with that type of clientele on a day-to-day basis. So I had to employ people as a buffer between me and it. It was great creating the experiences, but then the actual reality of working with very demanding people to fulfill them sort of took the shine off it for me. So I sold that business and then I was in a partnership business in high performance teams and leaders, which is going back to a lot of my roots of the phys ed and sporting days, in how to build a high performing team and how to help the transition from being a manager to an emerging leader to a leader. And that was great. And it was through that relationship that I was introduced to Haas Dalal. And Haas is the ex-chairman of SBS and CEO of the Australian Multicultural Foundation. He asked me to get involved to assist a group of Italian artisans who wanted to bring an exhibition of Leonardo's machines to Australia, Leonardo da Vinci's machines. And so I got involved with that and saw a big opportunity and organised to bring it down here to Waterfront City when the Docklands was just opening up, and we put it on down there, and it did very, very well. I think we had about 118,000 visitors, and
I remember going to it.
Oh, did you?
Fascinating. Okay. Saw it in the Herald Sun.
So it was fascinating, but I looked at it from a critical eye and thought, wow, this could be so much better. And it's only telling part of a story of a very, very fascinating individual. And I didn't think the Italians that I were working with were behind it. I thought they'd ripped it off from somewhere. And so I went to Italy to sort of find out a little bit more about it. And, sure enough, I found the person behind it all, and we started to form a relationship, and I gave him a vision that I wanted to build the largest, most comprehensive exhibition on Leonardo da Vinci that had been done, because it hadn't really been done. Mm. There was lots of small exhibitions, and he hadn't left a lot of original artifacts behind, you know, that have survived 500 odd years. So every exhibition that gets put on by someone only contains a small amount of artifacts, and that doesn't really make a full story or the complete story of Leonardo. So I wanted to augment that and create something that told that story. So long and short of it, I had to go to Italy with my family to live for a year, which was not too hard to take. And so we did that. We started off living in Rome, but then I had three young children, you know, 6, 5, and 3, and I think I would have lost one of them pretty quickly in the Rome traffic. You know, Australian kids like to play outside, and Rome's not very conducive to having kids in the heart of Rome. So I end up moving out into Umbria, where I was between Florence and Rome, and you know, the family had a great property to, you know, to live on, and I was able to transit between the two.
Gotcha.
And so I lived there for a year to develop that experience.
Yeah. So it's because I've read God, who wrote his biography? He did the Jobs biography as well.
Isaacson,
yeah. Brilliant biography. It's really interesting to learn about his early life and just the world at that time as well.
It is fascinating.
Yeah. Was it the Medici family as well that commissioned a lot of his work?
And Sforza's in Milan, yes. Yeah. So mostly the Sforza's, but yeah, most of his work that we know, the inventions and like, came through from his time in Milan.
Yeah.
Look, he was anointed the master artist from a very, very young age, but his curiosity stopped him from finishing art because he was trying to be perfect in the art. He was almost painting like a photographer.
Mm.
Like, there was nothing abstract about it. It was really trying to recreate perfect detail.
Yeah,
but to create perfect detail, he actually had to understand physics and biomechanics and human body more, et cetera. So it led him down this path of knowledge. The very, very interesting thing about Leonardo, which most people don't know, and this is why I got fascinated and wanted to tell the story, because you're talking about four of the biggest brands in the cultural world with the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, you know, his self-portrait and the Vitruvian Man. And most people recognize those things, but prior to the exhibition that we created and, you know, the masses of people had gone through, most people still don't understand much about Leonardo.
Mm.
But he was, you know, he was born illegitimate, which means he wasn't afforded an education. You know, his father was a notary, so his father taught him a lot of what he knew, and then he was self-taught. So he was questioning everything that the church was teaching all the scholars at the time. And he was proving or disproving it through experimentation. And he had, if you like, open slather, because there was so much false information out there at the time that he was able to disprove many things or go a step further. And so he got involved in everything from astronomy to geology to cutting up cadavers to understand how the heart worked. You know, he's the first to understand how the eye refracts light. You know, it was all these amazing new discoveries that he made. But he was supposed to be an artist, and so he couldn't make money because he was too busy doing the experiments to put back into his art, but he wasn't completing enough art to sell.
Mm.
In fact, Michelangelo sold more in one sculpture than Leonardo earned in his entire life, yet they were sort of arch rival contemporaries at the same time. So he sold his services to the Sforza family in Milan as a military strategist. And that's when he was allowed to go and do all his engineering, you know, studies that he did. But it was very challenging for him because he was a pacifist, vegetarian, 6'6", you know, gay, left-handed, thought very differently. So in those times, you were socially very, very different.
Yeah.
You know, he's left behind a massive legacy. For those that get involved in Leonardo, because he's a muse for so many CEOs around the world. It's incredible.
And sort of really not created, but he was one of the chief entrepreneurs of the Renaissance, right? You know, like it was really born out of people like him. It's really fascinating.
Without a doubt. I mean, we think of Leonardo da Vinci, you know, as the pinnacle of that of that time, because the two things that were most important to these big families at the time, the Medicis and the Sforzas and like, were military might and power and
social
art.
Capital. Art, yeah.
Yeah.
So how many years, because the business was launched in 2005, the business today was obviously very different to what it was in 2005. So you got touring experiences, the Loom, obviously, and you now own Museo di Leonardo da Vinci. In 2009, I think it was this combination of seeing a projection-based environment in France, but also just picking up on things like your kids being bored at museums along the way. How many years was it until you got away from just doing the museum to starting to branch out into other areas like the touring experiences and coming up with the original stories like Van Gogh and so forth?
So we started life back in 2006, 2005, 2006, as a artifact-based exhibition company. So we were taking original artifacts and creating artifacts. So with Leonardo, was really taking his drawings and bringing them to life from his codices. But we created a huge exhibition over 1,500 square meters, and then we toured that. So we would license that to museums and galleries and science centers around the world. And that was so popular, we built a second one. So it became a replicable experience for us. And we have five of those actually, and still going now.
Yeah.
Obviously not the same as back then. They're a living beast, shall we say, where you're continually upgrading and improving and changing. But you're absolutely right. The traditional museum experience was highlighted to me living over in Italy, how complacent it was and how underwhelming it was for many visitors. Yeah. It was almost like there were a lot of people, not all of course, but a lot of people, I need to like this because I should like this, but I really don't like this.
My friend said I have to go here.
Yes. Yeah. And no more than the Louvre. The Louvre was actually an inspiration, and a lot of people really disagree with me here, and that's fine. But look, the Louvre gets 10 million visitors a year, and 999,000 of them run straight up the second floor, straight into the room where the Mona Lisa is, and go, well, shit, it's way over there in the distance. It's so small.
Yeah.
It's behind two pieces of bulletproof glass. And the Louvre, which really makes most of its finances off that piece of art, and if you go down the merchandise store, 97% of it's got Mona Lisa on the front cover.
It's good.
You know, they give you a plaque, La Gioconda, 1503 to 1506, Leonardo da Vinci. And that's it. So people go, hang on, I've just travelled halfway, well, all the way around the world or halfway around the world. Run up here. How underwhelming is that? I can't get close to it. I don't see it. And she's ugly, but they don't understand anything. And that's the key. If you don't understand the story behind something, you will never appreciate it. And the Louvre doesn't give people that story. They have artifacts more than they can display. You know, most of them are still down the vault underneath. But it's lacking that ability to tell the story to the people to make a connection on why Mona Lisa is so so wonderful, why she is the epitome of the best piece of art, arguably, that's ever been created. And until you delve into that, it's very hard to make that connection.
Yeah. And that's essentially where you started to become a content producer. You started to build original IP.
Yeah, well, we're looking at how to do something better than it's being done at that particular time. So when we moved ourselves into multimedia, that was a direct consequence. It took us 2 years to work out how to develop that. I saw the concept in Le Beau in Provence in France in an old limestone quarry, but to then be able to take that out on the road and tour it around the world, no one had ever done that before. And it took us 2 years to actually work out how to create a large, you know, multi-projection, multi-sound, projection-based, you know, platform and system to tour that you could set up in 7 days. Travel in two 40-foot containers and then leave it in situ overseas for 3-4 months and come back and pack it up and move it to the next place without physically having to be there and operate it every single day.
And those 2 years, when, talk to me as an entrepreneur, what was that time like in terms of getting the approval from venues? Like, did you do it in a way from a business strategy in that you said, hey, I'm the guy that's operated this museum. We've already tested this format in the museum in little ways. I've got this concept. Let me bring it to you. And they often, what, came back to you with, yep, we'll do it. Or no, you just got to pay a venue hire and it's on you and you're a promoter essentially.
Yeah, sure.
What was that like?
Yeah, look, I took a very different approach to everything that had been done beforehand because I didn't come from the arts world and I didn't come from the world of creating exhibitions within a museum that would then loan them or license them to another museum. I was one of three companies in the world that were sitting outside that infrastructure. There was ourselves. There was a company called Premier Exhibitions, which is now no longer, that did the Titanic exhibition, which came here to Melbourne.
Right.
And there was another company called Body Worlds, which did the human plastinated bodies. And we would follow each other everywhere.
Yeah.
And often we would go in first because we were probably less expensive, less risk, but had the bigger brand and attracted a lot more sponsorship because it had a much bigger appeal, Leonardo, to sponsors and others than dead bodies did and the Titanic. So, yeah, arguably looking back, one of the biggest challenges we had was what is an Australian company, an Australian person doing with an Italian brand that's second only to God? And how's that connection made? But it was made through the deep roots of connection that I had in Italy and drawing on those because we had a credibility thing to hop over initially,
You did.
And Australia's really bad for it, really bad for it. We could not get acceptance here in Australia until we'd been 10, 15 years in existence overseas because Australians don't accept Australians very well, in terms of punching at a world class, level. If I had promoted ourselves as an Italian company or a French company, it'd be totally different here.
I've said that to my wife a lot, Lauren, who you just met, and the best experiences we've ever had. I thought the Loom was the only one in Melbourne, by the way, that is to this day, I think since 2012, for me matched anything we've experienced in Europe. And it's a real testament to what you guys have done with it. And for me, it was realizing things like at Bilbao. I can't remember the artist's name, but there was you could call him a sort of modernist style painter, British guy, often does landscapes. And the way that was just a wing of Bilbao.
Yeah.
And it was multimedia. It was like, artifacts plus him doing an interview plus going and drawing. And I thought, like, wow, this is just unreal. But also, this was only one component of many within this entire museum. So, it was super, super impressive, but also it just goes to show we really lack that stuff here. And I think that's why the Looms perform so well. It's
quality.
Yeah.
Melbourne and Australia kids itself a little bit about where we punch on the cultural stage.
Yeah.
You wouldn't find too many other cities around the world of the size of Melbourne lacking so many cultural facilities.
Yeah,
we are dominated by a few, but we certainly don't have many. But a city of this size somewhere else around the world might have 90 or 100 different museums, galleries, institutions, and of size. We just don't. We haven't invested in the infrastructure here in Melbourne.
Also, probably because they have the volume of visitors. That's the big thing for me. Is like I look at somewhere like Bilbao and Rome. There'd be more people going there every year than Melbourne, right?
Yeah, see, I'd almost argue back the other way a little bit in terms of
build and they'll come.
A little bit. I mean, Bilbao people go because of the fantastic building of the Guggenheim there and it's captured people's imagination. But, they've had the foresight to invest in that and understand that that investment is going to pay dividends for that city for years and years and years and years to come. where's that vision in Melbourne? We really struggled. You know, we didn't get any support, you know, or very little support to bring the loom and put it on in Melbourne.
Mm.
And because Melbourne's very concentrated on short-term events, and we're set up to put a lot of money behind short-term events with the way Visit Victoria operates and how we bring in the soccer games and the basketball games and the Bledisloe Cups and the Grand Prix and that. But they're short-term, short activation events, and the city's been built on that, and we do it as well as anybody around the world.
Yeah.
But when it comes to actually building, the Loom's a permanent digital art gallery here in Melbourne. I'll put it back to you. What was the last cultural institution of significance built in Melbourne?
The NGV.
But well, I'll help you out. You're going back to ACME in 2000.
Oh, wow.
So what have we done for the last 20 years in this area?
Yeah.
Not a lot. We've concentrated and kept it all within the NGVs and the Melbourne Museums and the ACMEs because they're owned by the government. That's where the government funds its money. But it doesn't actually move beyond that to help build infrastructure outside of that.
Outside of those little domains, yeah.
Yep.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. So how do you go about, like, okay, that was, when it comes to experience design, I feel like we've touched a lot of things. You know, you mentioned before the story. You mentioned about it's got to be cost efficient from freight and production. You've got to be able to put it away for 3 months, I think you said, be able to have a good brand. How do you go about selection of locations? That was an interesting thing to me, in that your exhibitions, they're often large in size. The brand we mentioned before must be affordable to license the IP if you're having to. Mm. And again, low production costs. It's quite a unique combination. How do you go? Because is that what I would assume that's what your job is today, is finding those next things, right? How do you go through that process?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. You've got, in my industry, you've got everything from concept through to creation of the experience itself. So creating the, you know, the content, the IP, the asset. But then once you've got that, you've then got to distribute it. And that brings in another equation of, when the world is your market, you'd be kidding yourself if you thought that you knew everything around the world. So you rely on local partners a lot. So that's where we would, yeah, we don't self-promote what we do overseas. We right. We own and promote the Loom here in Melbourne, because we can understand this market, and we're here. But it would be, you know, very foolish of me to think that I could go to Berlin and open up an experience there ourselves and own it, run it, and market it, because I've got no idea how the Berlin market operates from a marketing perspective, nor where the right building is in the right part of town. Mm. And I learned this very early on. I did an exhibition in San Francisco, and we were just simply on the wrong side of the street. If we had been on the other side of the street, everyone told me it would have been a smash success. But because we were on the other side of the street, we were past the threshold where that you know, a
foot traffic would go.
Demographic of San Francisco that would come to our experience would not step over that side of the street. Wow. And in fact, the day before we opened, there was a murder at our front door.
Jesus.
And that's a rookie mistake. You know, in terms of not understanding the mechanics of a city. Yeah, we also have things like, you know, here in Australia, if we were to put Leonardo or French Impressionists or Vincent van Gogh or like in a shopping center, it has a connotation with that.
Mm.
But in large sections of the world, that's exactly where it goes and where you want it to go, because that's where the people are comfortable to go to experience that. So again, very different in different parts of the world. But we do. We always have a challenge with venues, because we're looking for large venues. We need high ceiling heights. We need large, expansive, you know, open plans, and you want them in, you know, great locations in a city. Well, most cities can't offer that.
Mm.
So you're then weighing up smaller venues in the right location versus larger venues in not so good a location.
Yeah.
And that's where you've really got to test the market as to how much of a destination what you have become, so it doesn't matter so much, versus actually being in the heart of things where it's accessible for people because you're picking up more foot traffic and all that.
Yeah, and then there's no perfect science to this because we've launched a touring business for our talent, like comedy and music, and figuring out things like what's the right ticket price.
Yeah.
You know, we know what our underlying costs are.
Yeah.
But realistically, do we think we can get this many people at this venue?
Yeah.
Particularly if we run ads or if it's just organic or whatever. Yep. Yep. That's the fun stuff, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the art to the science. You know, there is science behind it all, but it's also a little bit of an art. And I mean, we've, you know, no qualms, you know, the ticket prices in what we produce, you know, have basically doubled in 4 years. But they were very, very undervalued before. Mm. I mean, you could go and get a coffee and a muffin for the same price or less than entering into a multi-million dollar exhibition, because the arts world and the museum world doesn't help itself a lot because it lowers the price so that it's affordable for the lowest common denominator, but it does that often on the back of government money or donor money or alike. So very few of them are actually self-sufficient businesses in their own right. They're subsidized heavily, but it also puts a connotation of, well, that's your ticket price.
Hmm.
Now, once we moved outside of that, the Loom, for example, is not seen by the public as going to the museum or the gallery. It's actually seen to be more comparable to a night at the theatre or a light. So it becomes very, very affordable at our pricing because it's providing hours of entertainment. I mean, we've had, you know, the average dwell time in there is close to 2 hours, but we've had people in there for 6 or 7 hours. So,
well,
it becomes affordable.
Yeah, because then it becomes a substitute for going to the movies or the theatre or the footy or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious, just thinking about back to the Loom, when you go through that process of setting the whole thing up, do you have a whole creative team that come in here from a technical point of view, or do you just handball that to a team and say, this is what I want, this is what it has to look like, blah, 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 or is it all just left to them? Like, what's that process?
Yeah, no, it's very collaborative. We have our in-house production and creative teams, and it's a fine balance between how much I interfere or not in that process. Certainly, I'll outline the vision and we'll do the big picture scoping together, but then I allow them to get on with the detail, and then there's various check-in points to make sure we're on track with things, or if they hit some speed bumps or some different ideas about what we first thought, we'll come back and regroup on them. But I'm very hands-off. You know, I've got, you know, a very, very talented creative and technical team that I probably could just hand it all over to.
Yeah.
But I need to do something and feel important, so I've got to get involved.
So one of the big things I wanted to ask you was around, we're talking before about experience-based agencies. You know, every Big Four agency in the advertising space claims to have an experiential design or, user experience agency in amongst their teams, you know, 200-plus brands often of agencies. What is it that you think agencies can learn from you as an original IP developer that they can impart on brand-related experiences that maybe you've seen in the past or would like to see more of?
Yeah, look, I actually think that's one of the future trends coming up is integrating what we do in the arts cultural world, which has really reimagined that entire industry and taken it on a pathway that no one would have envisaged, you know, outside of what we do, you know, 10 years ago. But you can see that moving into so many different areas now. And certainly, I think we're seeing more and more of some of the higher end brands starting to integrate very immersive, very high tech digital experiences to engage with the public. But it all comes down to storytelling and that's where it falls amiss a little bit, because the storytelling and the storytelling, and there's immersive and there's immersive. I mean, my daughter sat in on a Monash University lecture the other day, and it was billed as an immersive lecture, an immersive, and it was a PowerPoint presentation. I mean,
yeah.
It was just, it's a buzzword to try and hook people in.
Mm.
So I think there's a, one of the challenges is always going to be how something is marketed to the delivery of the actual experience.
Yeah.
And that's where the biggest disconnect is. And I think one of the great things, not being involved in social media too much, is trying to sift through fact from fiction all the time, because there's so much false information and so much things to influence you and the way you think out there, but it comes through subtle marketing of different things. Whereas when you are living and eating and breathing that experience as a visitor, that's when you know whether you've been conned or whether you've been actually delivered on the promise.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned something earlier as well around how we do short-term really well here in Australia, but maybe not so much long-term. And I think that's the biggest thing I've picked up being in this sort of PR talent-y space, is that there's a cookie-cutter approach, and that maybe it's for a fashion and beauty brand. It's like it's a couple of influencers. They got a goodies bag. They got a showing day every quarter of the brands that are with the PR agency, and you get this, this, and that. But I just wonder, like, what would it be if this was an impermanent experience that the talent, obviously you launch with the talent, but then other people could come and see and learn about the brand. There's so many good brands you work there that have been around for 50, 60 years. They're just so used to taking this commercial transactional approach that I just wonder, well, there's so many stories behind these brands.
Yeah, look, I think they're starting to be unlocked. Yeah, I've had multiple conversations over in Europe with some of the big brands, you know, and where they're trying to go with things. And they understand the consumer as well as anybody, and they understand their consumer very, very well. But it's not transactional, you know, anymore. You can't just open up a store and put your product in there and have people walk in and spend tens of thousands of dollars on it, or tens of, you know, dollars, or, you know, multiple hundreds of dollars anymore. There's a whole online world. There's a whole experiential world. The demands are greater. The trap that they're trying not to fall into, but it's very difficult, is the short term, because everything's so short term now. Everything's about a quick win and a quick gain, whether it be to get quarterly results up for a listed company, or whether it's activations because we need to do something this quarter, and often forget the long game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a big, like, just when you talk about the short and long of it, like the short, yes, you're going to increase sales volume, but you need to increasingly do long-term brand plays, because that is what increases your prices and prevents you from being commoditized in a relevant industry. All right, let's finish off with some rapid-fire questions. Now, what do we have? Your routine. What does it look like at the moment in the morning and the evening?
I've operated for my whole life, apart from the last 4 months, without an EA.
Okay.
And my EA is trying to build some routine into my life, and it's getting totally ignored because there isn't one. And I think this is it's a strength, but it's also a great frustration, because without routine, it's very hard to be consistent with certain things, and you know, sort of keeping on top of your own health and fitness and life and balance and all those sort of things. But without that routine comes sometimes creativity and an ability to just really do what needs to be done in the moment. And long and short of it, I don't have a routine apart from my routine is a lack of routine.
Yeah. Do you consistently have like a coffee or tea in the morning?
Oh, look, those, certainly the coffee's the routine. There's okay. got to be a couple of strong coffees, before 11 o'clock, and then don't touch coffee pretty much after that. Be quite rare, but I'm that type of person that can't eat the same thing 2 days in a row, be it breakfast or anything. I'm after something.
You have to do something different.
Yeah, and I'm not that type of person like a lot of, you know, successful businessmen are that wake up at 5 a.m. and, you know, do an hour's exercise or punch out their 50Ks on the bike and no matter what the weather's like or that. You know, I've tried to remain very active, but always in different parts of the day, sometimes in the middle of the day, sometimes at the end. You know, I mean, I as a young bloke, I used to run at, 10:30 at night. Life just changes. But also we're a global business, and one of the challenges I have is, when Australia's awake, the rest of the world's asleep, and as we're about to finish a day, well, the UK and Europe starts waking up, and then, early in the morning, the US, especially the East Coast, is there only for a short period of time. So your work day is very, very extended and very ad hoc, depending on what's going on. And so you're trying to pinch other things throughout the day. It's not a routine life at all.
What's your item in the fridge that you keep going back to at the moment?
The only thing that's good for me in the fridge is some mineral water. We've had to rationalize. I put on a few kilos, especially 5 weeks overseas. So a lot of the bad things have disappeared out of the fridge, and my wife and I are trying to keep on the straight and narrow in the fridge. But look, I'm a sucker for anything that revolves around carbohydrates. So
pleasure? Like, are you a chocolate guy or savory?
Look, can't have biscuits around. I wouldn't have a lot of self-control around good biscuits.
Know. We've gone through this process recently in the office. I've got zero self-control.
Ice cream would be the go-to dessert, which is pretty boring, but I don't crave other things. I don't eat chocolate as a routine. Mm. The only thing I would routinely have every day would be coffee. The rest is trying to sort of mix it up a bit. But we're on the wagon at the moment, so there's been no alcohol and very small portions over the last couple of weeks.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm trying to maintain somewhat of a health kick before we head away, because I know I'm just going to be debaucherous as soon as I get over to Europe.
Well, food's such a great pleasure. And it's when you've amazing. Lived in Europe and Italy and the like, you really – I mean, Italians talk about food nonstop. And I just come back, obviously, from time over there eating raw seafood just nonstop. I can't get enough of it there. But it's easy to get the excess. And a couple of my staff over there, for example, they limit themselves to pasta once a week.
Mm.
Now, we don't know this, as foreigners. We can often think, how do the Italians stay so trim, taut and terrific when they've got all this pasta on the menu? Well, they don't do what we do, which is go and eat pasta for lunch and dinner and go through the entire menu. They really do have a bit of self-control around.
Yeah, they pace themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely like a cultural thing we haven't learned here. Bruce, it's been great having you in here. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, they probably can't find me, but they can find The Loom at theloom.com and Grande Experiences. I mean, we've got experiences all out there around the world, and it's just a matter of, looking on our website to see what's on and like or doing a bit of search on some of our branded experiences there. But I try and keep a very low profile myself and not be found.
We'll link all of that. But Bruce Peterson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on Uncommon.
Beauty. Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe, and of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.